The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was without form or shape, with darkness over the abyss and a mighty wind sweeping over the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good. God then separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, in the darkness he called night. Evening came and morning followed, the first day. Then God said, "Let there be a dome in the middle of the waters, to separate one body of water from the other." God made the dome, and it separated the water below the dome from the water above the dome. And so it happened. God called the dome sky. Evening came and morning followed, the second day. Then God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered into a single basin, so that the dry land may appear." And so it happened. The water under the sky was gathered into its basin, and the dry land appeared. God called the dry land earth, and the basin of water he called sea. God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth vegetation, every kind of plant that bears seed, and every kind of fruit tree on earth that bears fruit with its seed in it." And so it happened. The earth brought forth vegetation, every kind of plant that bears seed, and every kind of fruit tree that bears fruit with its seed in it. God saw that it was good. Evening came, and morning followed, the third day. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate day from night. Let them mark the seasons, the days and the years, and serve as lights in the dome of the sky to illuminate the earth." And so it happened. God made the two great lights, the greater one to govern the day, and the lesser one to govern the night and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to illuminate the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. God saw that it was good. Evening came and morning followed, the fourth day. Then God said, "Let the water teem with an abundance of living creatures, and on the earth let birds fly beneath the dome of the sky." God created the great sea monsters and all kinds of crawling living creatures with which the water teems and all kinds of winged birds. God saw that it was good, and God blessed them, saying, "Be fertile, multiply and fill the water of the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." Evening came and morning followed, the fifth day. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth every kind of living creature, tame animals, crawling things, and every kind of wild animal." And so it happened. God made every kind of wild animal, every kind of tame animal, and every kind of thing that crawls on the ground. God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make human beings in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the tame animals, all the wild animals, and all the creatures that crawl on the earth." God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fertile and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and all the living things that crawl on the earth." God also said, "See, I give you every seed-bearing plant on all the earth, and every tree that has seed-bearing fruit on it to be your food, and to all the wild animals, all the birds of the air, and all the living creatures that crawl on the earth. I give all the green plants for food. And so it happened. God looked at everything he had made and found it very good. Evening came and morning followed, the sixth day. Now, I could spend the entire lecture just continuing to read scripture, but I won't. What I just read to you is, of course, the first creation story of the book of Genesis. Against the background of modern scientific practice, that account of cosmic origins has been the occasion of controversy in what is best described as a cultural battle over where we came from, how we came to be what we are, and perhaps where we are going. In that battle, the natural sciences, particularly biology, are often used by one side to undermine the belief originating in Genesis that we and all the things we see about us come from God. We are what we are because of a divine creative act. And as the rest of Holy Scripture unfolds, we learn that God intends for us to return to Him. That is our destiny. However, we are all likely familiar with the modern progress of geology, which is thought by many to undermine the unfolding of creation as an orderly process of 6 days. Rather, billions and billions of years. More striking to our consciousness and in many ways more culturally useful to undermining the biblical story is the progress of modern evolutionary theory, originating in the late 18th century, virtually exploding in the work of Alfred Wallace and Charles Darwin on the evolution of species as natural selection, and in a kind of apotheosis of the theory in the 20th century, the neo-Darwinian synthesis of the theory of natural selection with Mendelian genetics. The idea is that evolutionary theory undermines the idea expressed in Genesis that God is responsible for the various species of life found on the earth. No, rather, the species of life are the result of strictly natural processes, including random genetic mutations and natural selection. The development and achievements of modern science are, without doubt, extraordinary. I marvel at them, and one thing that was not in my introduction is I was a physics major in college. And that turns out to be important for this. I'm not just bragging. I marvel at them and wholeheartedly accept them as the best accounts to date of the strictly natural processes by which the world over time came to be as we now observe it. But it is the cultural apologetics against biblical faith in Genesis that brings us here today. It's one thing to develop a natural science like physics, chemistry, or biology. It's another thing, and not a particularly scientific thing, to use such theories in a cultural argument about divine origins and their relevance to our lives. It's one thing to marvel at the use of the DNA testing of a skull of a Neanderthal man dug up in Germany to try to determine whether Neanderthal man was an ancestral species of Homo sapiens, a cousin species of Homo sapiens, or even an interbreeding species with Homo sapiens. That's science. It's another thing entirely to use the results of natural science to refute or undermine what is taken to be the religious understanding of universal origins in God, and that God's providence governs the world, governs even such natural processes as the evolution of species involving random mutation and natural selection. A cultural argument one will see, for example, in the work of Richard Dawkins. At its best, that kind of argument might be a philosophical argument, not an argument within natural science. At its worst, it can often be uninformed cultural politics. In fact, you'll notice a common theme in the cultural use of natural science against religious, specifically biblical, belief in a divine origin of the world. The biblical account and religious reflection upon it are treated as if they are elementary and crude efforts at natural scientific explanation. That is, as if they are scientific theories defeated by the much more sophisticated and better theories we now possess. The God theory is abandoned with the growing acceptance of evolutionary theory, and so on. In what I argue today, I want to reject that common assumption of those who, for lack of a better word, I will call the naysayers. First, however, I want to make a point right now to frame the discussion. It shouldn't have to be said, but it must be said, that not everything a natural scientist says has the authority of natural science, simply because it is a natural scientist, even a brilliant natural scientist who says it. A simple example is a brilliant natural scientist born and bred in South Carolina and teaching physics at USC, saying that shrimp and grits in South Carolina are far superior to shrimp and grits in North Carolina. That is likely true. But it does not have the authority of physics as a natural science standing behind it, no matter how brilliant the physicist is who says it. A more important example would be a brilliant evolutionary theorist telling us that because in the development of species, species compete in a dog-eat-dog way for scarce resources, that selfishness is a law of nature, and so human beings ought to be egoists in their actions towards one another. Selfishness drives evolutionary progress, so it ought to drive human progress. That conclusion about human life is not a conclusion of evolutionary theory, but a philosophical claim needing philosophical argument. As a philosophical claim, the evolutionary theorist has no particular expertise or authority to claim it. So we do not want to meekly grant the claims of someone like Richard Dawkins or Stephen Hawking simply because they are great scientists. Being great scientists does not make them great philosophers or aficionados of shrimp and grits. But I'm not here today to discuss the theory of evolution specifically, or frankly, even delicious low country shrimp and grits. Responses from the perspective of biblical religion to those cultural arguments is a well-worn subject matter with many scientifically and philosophically informed responses offered by believing Christians that there is no conflict between the marvels of the neo-Darwinian evolutionary synthesis and biblically based faith in God as a providential creator and redeemer. Rather, I want to consider an argument that has received less attention, but as a physics major, is actually closer to my heart. That argument concerns the cosmological theory called the Big Bang. I'll describe that theory presently, but it is another scientific theory that has been put to use in the cultural argument to undermine the traditional Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo. That is, that God created all that exists other than himself, presupposing nothing other than his own being, power, knowledge, and goodness. Very good. So that's just the slide that would be up here as we waited to start. That's the Genesis account, generated, by the way, by artificial intelligence. Yes, way. It's amazing. This is the Big Bang slide. And my fear is that you're just all going to be mesmerized the entire time, because it's going to be up there for a while, and it just keeps looping. So I'll describe that theory presently, but it is another scientific theory that has been put to use in the cultural argument to undermine the traditional Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo. That is, that God created all that exists other than himself, presupposing nothing other than his own being, power, knowledge, and goodness. Again, I'll describe that doctrine of creation ex nihilo soon enough. But the idea put forward by the great cosmologist Stephen Hawking is that there's no need of a creator God, because the Big Bang shows us that one can indeed get something from nothing without a creator God. That is, without the creator God of Christianity. So what I propose to do here is three things. First, I'll describe very inadequately the Big Bang theory of the contemporary natural science of cosmology. I will also describe how Stephen Hawking uses the scientific theory of the Big Bang in the cultural argument against the Christian belief that God created all things from nothing. Second, I will discuss the Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo against the background of both the book of Genesis and a similar story of beginnings and origins put forth by Plato in his dialogue Timaeus. Finally, I will briefly argue that, like evolutionary theory, there is in fact no conflict between a commitment to God as providential creator ex nihilo and the scientific theory of the Big Bang, despite what Stephen Hawking claims. So, the Big Bang. Let's start then with a simple and crude description of Big Bang cosmology. In the 1920s, the observational astronomer Edwin Hubble, for whom the orbiting telescope is named, observed that in all directions of the sky, galaxies are moving away from us, none toward us. He also observed that the further away a galaxy is, the faster it is moving away from us. This led him to formulate Hubble's law that states that the universe is expanding. Now, a century later, with the Big Bang theory already in our consciousness, it might seem obvious that one should immediately realize that the universe began from a very small point if it is constantly expanding. That was not obvious in the 1920s. One could have held first that the universe had no beginning and was forever in a structured state with all sorts of stars and galaxies, and then at some point began to expand. But the theory of the Big Bang is much more specific in asserting that the universe began after a singular event from an infinitely dense, energetic singularity in which there was no structure, not even the structure of space and time. After that Big Bang, as the energy density decreases with the expansion of space and time, more and more of the fundamental particles that make up our universe begin to appear as bits of matter and antimatter, almost as if, to use a metaphor, energy is freezing into matter as it cools and the temperature continues to go down and down. From these basic building blocks and under the influence of gravity, galaxies and stars begin to form, planets, and so on and so on. This theory is widely credited to the Belgian priest, Georges Lemaître. Georges Lemaître's cosmological theories formulated in the 1920s. Lemaître had used Einstein's theory of general relativity to trace the mathematics of the expansion backwards instead of forwards, theorizing that given the observational data of Hubble, if one followed these equations backwards, one had to come to a singularity in the Einsteinian laws. A singularity is a mathematical concept. Essentially, it means the mathematical functions that express the laws of general relativity describe an ever-shrinking space-time structure until they approach an asymptotic point, approaching zero and infinite energy density, where they are no longer defined, and now no longer to be mesmerized. So there you have your, really it should say energy density, but the way it typically is described popularly is the temperature of the universe, okay? So as time goes on, the temperature goes down asymptotically, but never hits zero, okay? If you go back, right, as it approaches time zero, asymptotically, the temperature or energy density goes up, but never hits zero. Right? It's one of those fun functions from either grade school. When I was a kid, we didn't do that sort of stuff, but now my kids get this in grade school. But one of those sort of fun functions, mathematical functions that you're like, wait a minute, it never hits? Yeah, it never hits. It just keeps getting closer and closer without ever hitting. And so zero is a singularity. Okay? Zero is a singularity. So singularity is a mathematical concept. Essentially, it means the mathematical functions that express the laws of general relativity describe an ever-shrinking space-time structure until they approach an asymptotic point, approaching zero, and infinite energy density where they are no longer defined. So the function is well-defined on all its points, but it has no definition at zero. It has no value at zero. And so mathematically, it's undefined at zero. Okay? And that's very important for what's going to happen here. And the functions do not reach zero. The point is that at zero, the functions have no defined value. They don't exist as functions at that point. Now, it's important to keep in mind that the claim isn't just that the sum total of energy is shrinking as you go backwards, but that time and space remain the same. No, the structure of time and space themselves are shrinking. One of the features of Einstein's theory is that time and space, instead of being an independent and absolute receptacle of things, as Isaac Newton had supposed, are themselves bound up with the energy and matter of the universe and change with it. That's all the relativity stuff. So as you go back in time, so also does space in particular, itself gets smaller and smaller, approaching zero. At the asymptote, there is no space or time. Space and time are themselves the result of the Big Bang. In that respect, one might call that asymptotic point nothing. No space, no time. As Stephen Hawking, in fact, does call it, nothing. Because general relativity has nothing to say about it. However, Lemaître's theory was not at first widely accepted as true. Einstein, listening to Lemaître lecture on it, on his theory, said, "Your math is beautiful, and your physics atrocious." Even the title Big Bang was meant to be an insult, directed at the theory by the famous British cosmologist Fred Hoyle, who in the late 1940s proposed his own steady-state theory as an alternative to Lemaître. In the steady-state theory, the universe is eternal, having no beginning, and is unchanging on a large scale, with the constant appearance of new matter to maintain a constant average density of matter as the universe expands. Calling Lemaître's theory the Big Bang theory was meant to be an insult, but the name stuck. Lemaître himself named his theory the hypothesis of the primeval atom. Over the decades, however, it grew in popularity among physicists, with the exception of Hoyle, until it was finally confirmed in 1965 by the discovery of the cosmic microwave background radiation just a year before Lemaître's death in 1966. This cosmic radiation is essentially heat from the remnants of the Big Bang explosion dating to the time the universe was about 380,000 years old and cool enough to allow for free radiation to travel throughout the universe. Hoyle's theory could not account for that background radiation. But the key to the Big Bang theory for our purposes is the positing of an infinitely dense state of energy in which there is no time and space, just energy. In a way, you could say it was smaller than small was allowed to be by the laws of general relativity. Stephen Hawking's insight is to apply the physics of very small things to that infinitely dense energy that is smaller than small is allowed to be. In quantum mechanics, very small things like protons, neutrons, electrons, and even much smaller things become very difficult to characterize with the ordinary laws of classical physics that we get from Newton and his successors. We cannot simultaneously characterize the position and momentum of a particle, for example, or the energy of a particle at a particular time. Quantum mechanics solves that problem by substituting probability functions for very small things, functions that in effect describe the probability, not the small thing, but the probability for any very small particle to be in a particular state at any particular place or time. These functions are called state functions. One aspect of them is you don't have to rely upon identifying a particular cause for an effect you observe. You can simply appeal to the probability that the effect will occur. Indeed, you can appeal to a simple random You can appeal to a simple random probabilistic fluctuation in the state to explain a subsequent state. That's about as far down into characterizing quantum mechanics as I want to go, which may be way too far. What Stephen Hawking, along with others, realized is that you could apply the idea of quantum mechanics to that state of infinite energy density, that is, an undefined singularity in general relativity. You don't have to find a cause for why the state collapses in the Big Bang and starts to expand. All you have to do is posit a random quantum fluctuation for which the state function provides a probability among all the other probabilities. If you throw a fair die, each face will randomly come up an equally probable number of times, 1 out of 6. But if you throw 2 such dice, then snake eyes will come up only 1 out of 36, where 7 will come up 1 out of 6. That is 6 times more probable than snake eyes. And there will be a similar probability distribution for all the other possible outcomes as well, 8 or 5, 9 or 4, and so on. The explanation for why the Big Bang happened just turns out to be that it is likely that it was the most probable but random quantum outcome of the state function of the infinite but undefined energy density that preceded the Big Bang. In short, the Big Bang resulted from what Hawking once called a, quote, random quantum fluctuation in the void, end of quote. I used to say to people, when you find yourself saying random quantum fluctuation in the void, just think, so you don't know. It's beautiful physics, but the general relativity of Lemaître's theory of the primeval atom and Stephen Hawking's and others' most recent application of quantum mechanics to it. It's beautiful physics, both the general relativity of Lemaître's theory of the primeval atom and Stephen Hawking's and others' more recent application of quantum mechanics to it. But what interests me is what Hawking and others then do with that beautiful physics when they claim that therefore there is no need of a creator God. Since he claims the theory, as he describes it, shows that you can, in fact, get something from nothing. You can have a creation ex nihilo of being from the nothing that is the singularity in the theory. Nothing becomes something with no prior cause. Here again, you see a claim being made that goes outside the science itself. You see a philosophical claim using the science to dispute a central claim of Christianity. And once again, those claiming it are assuming that the Christian doctrine they are rejecting is a competing scientific theory that must give way in the face of this better theory of the random quantum fluctuation in the void, akin to the way Newtonian classical physics had to give way in the face of general relativity and quantum mechanics, or the Lamarckian theory of the evolution of species had to give way to the better theories of Wallace and Darwin. God, on their picture, is really just a competing cause, with the natural causes they describe, only a crude and ineffective one that is better cast into the dustbin of history along with Ptolemaic epicycles or the caloric fluid theory of heat transfer, thrown away for the better kinetic theory of heat transfer. But is this so? Let's turn to the Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo to see whether it is in fact put forward as a competing scientific theory where God competes with natural causal explanations for space in our understanding of how the world operates. If we look back to the biblical story of Genesis, it must be admitted that on its face, it doesn't seem to describe God as responsible for everything whatsoever that exists other than himself. It begins with a chaotic void where the earth, apparently meaning unformed dirt, is covered over by teeming waters that appear to be everywhere. That's how it starts. What God does is begin to introduce order into this chaos, separating the waters from the uncovering the earth. Also, he puts a dome in the midst of the waters to separate the waters above the dome from the earth and the waters he has separated below the dome, thereby making the sky out of chaos. The story goes on in an ordered fashion to display increasing organization of the waters below the dome into sea creatures and the dirt of the earth into land creatures, culminating in the organization of the human as male and female, made to the image of God. In that respect, there is a certain similarity to both the theory of evolution and the theory of the Big Bang, since all display a kind of unfolding of increasing order from apparent disorder. But the similarity stops there, since neither of the latter theories appeal to God as a principle of the increasing organization. Before proceeding, however, one thing should be pointed out. Only relatively few Christians have ever believed that one should take the Genesis story at a simple face value reading. Christians who in the 20th century came to be called biblical fundamentalists, but they weren't the first. It's just that that hasn't been the major sort of populace of biblical readers throughout Christian history. Very early, most Christians recognized that Holy Scripture uses many images and metaphors characteristic of the times in which the books were written to communicate something about reality that is very difficult to communicate without the images and metaphors. For example, St. Augustine would point out in the 4th century that the sun is not created until the 4th day. But how can you have days, specifically the first three, without a sun? Well, you have to understand the use of the term day in the 7 days as using an image and metaphor to communicate something. What does it communicate? Orderly progression of intelligibility unfolding in creation. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's like a grocery list. I need to go to the grocery store. I'm not just going to write things all over the page. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Creation is not chaotic, but well-ordered and intelligible. Compare if I say Notre Dame destroyed South Carolina in the playoff. Really? So where are all the dead bodies? That's a simple face value interpretation of what I've said. No. I make a point about the character of the game as it happened that you could not understand simply by reading the final score and game stats. It communicates something to you about reality that the stats don't. So I use the image of destruction to communicate that point. Metaphor and image are woven into and inseparable from our speech. I often challenge my students to speak about the world for just one day without using a single metaphor. Maybe you should try to do so as well. I'm finding myself doing it all the time, just now. Hadn't noticed this one. Metaphor and image are woven into and inseparable from our speech. I just wrote that sentence yesterday, I think. And I just wrote it. Just wrote it. Didn't even think about it. And I used the word inseparable. Separability is a metaphor. But what does it tell you about our speech and the use of metaphor? Even scientific theories use metaphors. Quantum theory tells us that very small things are both waves and particles. Evolutionary theory tells us that the process of natural selection selects the most fit and well-adapted species for survival in the competition for scarce resources. Yes, contemporary natural science also uses mathematical functions to express natural laws. By the way, is the use of the term law in natural law a metaphor? Nietzsche actually asks that in Beyond Good and Evil. He doesn't ask it, he asserts it. But those mathematical functions are themselves just images of what they describe. They're not the reality described. The universal law of gravitation that explains, in some sense, the apple falling on Newton's head is not the apple that falls on Newton's head. In fact, as a mathematical function, it is nothing like the apple. And yet we use it to describe the apple. This is not a pipe. This is not a pipe. Is this talking about this is not a pipe? That's the joke, right? We think the joke is, well, that's not a pipe. And he put that in the painting. But guess what? This is not a pipe either. And yet we use it. It's nothing like a pipe. And yet we use it to bring to mind pipes and characterize them. Ceci n'est pas une pipe. So we need to understand that Holy Scripture requires interpretation when we read it as describing reality. But so does everything that we say with words or depict need interpretation. Every word, everything we say brings to mind something that isn't that word. And in that respect, not necessarily a visual, but in that respect, words themselves are images. That's what Plato knew. That's what the allegory of the cave is about, which he depicts with a dialogue in words.
I love Plato.
It's that reflection upon biblical interpretation that helps us to understand how the doctrine of creation ex nihilo developed. As I mentioned above, on its face and crudely interpreted, the Genesis story does not appear to depict a creation from nothing. It appears to depict a creation from something. Indeed, a lot of somethings. Lots of water and earth covered by water. God is depicted as acting upon stuff that already exists and is ready to hand. In fact, the Genesis story is very much like a concise version of another ancient story of origins, namely that given by Plato in the dialogue Timaeus. In that dialogue, Socrates provides what he calls a myth of the origin of the world as we know it, a world that appears to us as a mix of order and chaos. Originally, before the world was formed, there was chaos and logos, logos being the Greek word for order or intelligibility. The chaos consists of a receptacle of geometric solids of different shapes in a heap, while the logos is the realm of the forms. But it is the nature of chaos and intelligibility, the nature of chaos and intelligibility, or logos, to be opposed. And so they are separate from one another. In order to explain the mixture of logos and chaos as we observe it in the world around us, Socrates introduces an agent called the Demiurge, who can bring the logos of forms to the chaos of unorganized geometric solids. Through his intelligence, the Demiurge understands the best possible arrangement of the forms with one another and brings about the best possible world from the original chaos. So again, we see a story of origins in which a godlike figure now acts upon pre-existing stuff, stuff that the godlike figure is not responsible for, but finds ready to hand in order to form the world as we know it. The point that Stephen Hawking and others would make is that you don't need the agent. The logos is already in the chaos, as represented by the state function of the infinite energy density. You just have to wait for it to pop and watch the unfolding of the order in the chaos. But consider yet another origin or origins or beginning story. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things came to be through him. And without him, nothing came to be. This is the opening of the Gospel of John. We're more familiar with Word. The beginning was the Word. That's an unfortunate English term there. It's the translation of the Latin verbum from the Vulgate, but the verbum was the translation of the Greek logos. Word is a very narrow word in English, in its meanings. Much more narrow than verbum in Latin, and verbum in Latin is much more narrow than logos in Greek. Logos is not just a kind of spoken thing. its intelligibility, reason, order. I think we kind of lose that in the English word. This is the opening of the Gospel of John. The opening, the opening with, in the beginning, should remind the reader of Genesis, which also starts with, in the beginning. However, the Apostle John seems to suggest that there's a beginning before the beginning of the world in the book of Genesis. The beginning that John speaks of must be before the beginning of Genesis, because it says that this beginning, which is the Logos, that is with God and is God, is that from which all things came to be, and without him nothing came to be. So the coming to be of the world as it is, all those things which came to be in Genesis in the beginning, came from this beginning in the Logos, which precedes the beginning of Genesis. This discussion of Logos is different from Plato's, where the Logos and the Chaos are distinct from and preexistent alongside the Demiurge, who brings them together. Not so in the Gospel of John. Now the Logos is God, the agent responsible for all those things that come to be. Still, one might ask of John whether those things that come to be by the agency of the Logos, who is God, come to be from a pre-existing chaos that the Logos acts upon. In other words, have we shrunk to two pre-existing principles from Plato's three? It's that question that we can identify as prompting the development of the doctrine of creation ex nihilo in the life of the early church. The doctrine states that all things whatsoever that exist apart from God owe their entire existence at every moment of their existence to the causal agency of God. In addition, God's causal agency in creating and sustaining in existence all things other than himself presupposes nothing other than God's own wisdom, that is Logos, and God's power. God in creation acts upon no pre-existing matter or chaos to form what comes to be. Updating the terms a bit for our age, both the energy and the matter of the universe are among, quote, all the things that come to be, unquote, spoken of in the Gospel of John. Had God not created, all that would exist would be God and nothing else. Not God and the Logos and the Chaos, not even God and the Chaos, just God alone. So despite the images of the book of Genesis or Plato's Timaeus, God does not act upon anything in making all things that come to be. Anything that is, in every aspect of its being, whether we are speaking of its intelligibility or its materiality, indeed even its temporal and spatial relations, come to be from the creative act of God as it is at all times sustained in being by that creative act. That's the Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo. But why did that doctrine come to be? In the early church, you had an intellectual movement within the church called Gnosticism, influenced by certain philosophical themes from ancient Greek, as well as certain ascetical movements of self-denial. For the Gnostics, there were in fact two principles of all that comes to be in the world: the principle of good, which they identified with God the Logos of John, and the principle of evil, which they tended to identify with matter, or we might say the chaos. The world around us is a mix of good and evil, light and darkness, locked in an eternal battle. Think of Star Wars, which is fundamentally a Gnostic story. Luke. The more material something was, the more the principle of evil dominated in it. The more spiritual something was, the more the principle of good dominated in it. But essential to the story is that the principle of evil is co-eternal with and just as uncreated as the principle of good or God. The problem with this Gnosticism from the perspective of the life of the church is twofold. First, it plainly runs counter to Genesis, that describes the creation of the world in all its days as good, indeed very good. But we already know you have to be wary of plain sense reading of Genesis, as if it did not require interpretation. So presumably, the Gnostics could and did give interpretations of Genesis consistent with their view that matter, the stuff that God acted upon in forming the world, is evil. The second problem is more difficult, however. Scripture throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament portrays God as Almighty, Lord of all the earth. Everything is subject to his sovereignty over creation. And in the life of Jesus Christ, we see God become incarnate, become enfleshed, because God so loved the world that he gave his only Son that they might have life everlasting. God did not become mixed with evil by becoming incarnate. So to emphasize the goodness of the world as God created it and God's almighty power over all of it, the church develops over time the doctrine of creation ex nihilo. Nothing whatsoever that exists apart from God is uncreated by God, including the matter out of which things come to be in the world. And the intelligibility to be found in the world expressed in the way things exercise their natural causality and powers. Subsequently, Gnosticism will forever be considered a Christian heresy in the face of that doctrine. And the images of Genesis will be forever interpreted in the light of that doctrine. The truth that Genesis gives expression to is much greater than a plain and simple reading of the text suggests. It isn't just the trees, the sky, the earth, the sea creatures, land creatures, and human beings that God creates. It is also the material stuff out of which they arise that God creates. Now the conception of God can no longer be one of an agent in the world, rearranging the pre-existing stuff of the world. Now the conception of God is of a being responsible for the very existence of the world and all that is within it, including the agents and laws of nature by which things in the world form other things. God doesn't compete with the natural causes that operate within the world to bring about the existence of new species. God causes those natural causes to be, to exist as the natural causes they are, with their natural powers intelligibly acting as they do. In that sense, we should think of God as not a competing scientific hypothesis, competing with the natural causes for responsibility. No, God is an enabling cause. God enables the causes we see operative in the world around us to be the genuine causes they are. That's the sense in which creation is not a moment in the past. Creation is ongoing in the sense that God is why there is time, and there are moments in which natural causes operate. God's almightiness is Lord not just of material objects in the world, and not just of the world, but he is Lord of time and space, as bound up in the world, as Einstein said, of time and space that they are. I sometimes say to my students when we're going through the five ways in Aquinas, look, a presupposition of all five ways is that there is natural causality that works intelligibly. And the point of the five ways is that the best argument, the way we would put it now, the best argument for the existence of God now is that science works. Not that God competes with science, but that science works. Back to the Big Bang. Suppose we return then to the Big Bang. Does it pose an objection to the Christian doctrine that God creates the universe ex nihilo, as Stephen Hawking and others suppose? No. Indeed, I want to argue that the theory is perfectly consistent with the doctrine. But to see why this is so, we need to talk about nothing for a while. Okay, enough of that. We need to talk about nothing for a while. You might think it difficult to talk about nothing. But I'm a philosopher, and so you might easily believe that mostly I talk about nothing. In any case, you yourselves talk about nothing all the time. What was that sound in the next room? Oh, nothing. What are you doing with that gun? Nothing. There's nothing wrong with me. I searched for the fountain of youth and found only nothing. We use the word nothing in a myriad of different ways against a myriad of different backgrounds. And it does not mean exactly the same thing in those different contexts. What are you doing? Nothing. Meaning nothing that is of your concern. What was that sound in the next room? Nothing. Meaning nothing to be frightened of. In those instances, we are talking about something, but calling it nothing because of some interest of ours. Aquinas would call these uses of nothing, nothing secundum se, strictly speaking, nihil secundum se, but nothing secundum se, in a certain respect. Nothing in a certain respect. Some being or thing, but in a certain respect, not a being or thing relative to my or your interests. But consider, I searched for the fountain of youth and found nothing. That is different. I was looking for some being, some thing, and I did not find that being, that thing, in any respect. I found no thing, nothing. This sense of nothing, Aquinas would call nothing absolute, without qualification, nothing. No being at all in any respect. So in the case of the theory of the Big Bang, we need to consider what it is that a scientist might mean by nothing in the context and interests of the science. A scientist may use the term nothing in both of the senses I just described, nothing secundum se and nothing absolute. In terms of nothing absolute, a scientist might say, I was looking to discover the existence of neutrinos in my experiment, and I came up with nothing. No being that I was looking for was detected. On the other hand, a scientist may use nothing secundum se in the sense of a being that is not measurable or representable within the resources of her science. Consider an asteroid striking the Earth and destroying the dinosaurs, resetting the course of evolutionary history. Is it something or nothing? Well, if we consider the principles of life available to a biologist in terms of her science, it isn't something measurable or representable within biological science. It has an effect that may be measurable or representable. And the biologist may talk about a sudden cataclysmic surge of energy in evolutionary history. But so long as she stays within the resources available to her in her biology, asteroid is a nothing. And yet it is clearly a something for the astronomer. So it is nothing secundum se for the evolutionary theorist, even though it bears upon the reality of evolution that she is interested in. A simpler example would be me squishing a mosquito. Who knows what long-term evolutionary results, according to the butterfly effect, that squishing will have. However, the biologist has no tools available for representing me within evolutionary theory, or the very singular event that is my squishing of it. She can talk in general terms about biological and chemical events in the evolutionary history of mosquitoes, but she can't talk about me, John O'Callaghan, so long as she stays within the confines of the resources of biological science. For evolutionary biology, I am nothing. But I assure you, I am not nothing. I'm something. Just ask my kids, who will contribute to evolutionary history. But not as my kids. So to answer the question about Stephen Hawking and his argument employing Big Bang cosmology against Christian belief in a creator God, we have to ask how nothing is being used in the science he relies upon. Is it nothing secundum se or nothing absolute? It's pretty clear that it's nothing secundum se. Why? Well, because the idea is that the Big Bang is the result of a singularity. What did we see earlier is a singularity within a science like Big Bang cosmology, where the natural laws have a highly mathematicized representation. It's a point where the mathematical representations have no definition. They are strictly undefined at that point. For the purposes of the mathematical representation of the scientific model of the Big Bang, there is nothing at that point, because the science is incapable of measuring it or even representing it as something. And yet it is something in another respect. It is, as Stephen Hawking himself says, a singularity of infinitely dense energy, which again is to say energy that cannot be represented according to the laws of physics that follow upon the Big Bang, but are undefined prior to the Big Bang at that singularity. The best that Hawking can do in terms of representing this infinite energy density is to represent not it, but the probability that it will collapse and begin to cool according to the laws of physics that result from the collapse. And even that representation of probability is highly speculative, since no one can actually assign real values to the probabilities they speculate about, because it is a singularity in which the subsequent laws that arise break down when pushed to that point. That is a classic case of nothing secundum se, not nothing absolute. It is a something we cannot talk about as physicists. But the Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo is not contradicted by the Big Bang theory, understood as bearing upon this singularity of infinite energy density. The doctrine of creation ex nihilo does not speak of nothing secundum se, as the Big Bang theory does. The doctrine speaks of nothing absolute. Other than God, absolutely nothing exists in any sense at all but for the creative act of God. If the infinite energy density singularity of the Big Bang theory is something, though nothing representable by the theory, then if it is not God himself, it is created by God, and all that follows from it is created by God. God, by creating ex nihilo and sustaining the infinite energy density, is enabling the Big Bang and all the causes and laws of nature that follow upon it. Of course, Stephen Hawking is free to claim that the infinite energy density just is God, not created by God. But he has not actually offered any argument for that claim, and he would have a hard time doing so, at least as long as he sticks to the physics he so brilliantly pursued while alive. May he rest in peace. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.